You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of March 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
My reply to the question of Senator Franken was honest and correct, as I understood it at the time. I appreciate that some have taken the view that this was a false comment. That is not my intent. That is not correct.
Beleaguered U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions gets a vote of confidence from President Donald Trump following yesterday's unconvincing press conference. But does he have both feet off the trapdoor just yet? A spectacular cast of Monocle editors and correspondents will be joining me to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including China's biggest political week of the year, the difficulties of relocating the world's biggest fish market, and...
In worlds seen and unseen, where spirits are transformed.
Japan's homegrown cinema sensation, Your Name. All that and a new unit of measurement for engines on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. Welcome to Midori House. Later in the show, I will be joined by Monocle's Istanbul and Tokyo bureaus, but my first guests today are Ed Stocker from our New York bureau, Thomas Lewis from Toronto, and from our Hong Kong bureau, James Chambers. Now, first of all, it is a usually solid rule of cabinet-level political life that the day your party's leader declares their unstinting confidence in you is the day you should start clearing your desk. Nevertheless, US Attorney General Jeff Sessions appears determined to remain in office despite receiving precisely such a vote of confidence from US President Donald Trump. This follows yesterday's curious press conference, during which Sessions all but yelled from the bottom of the hole that his shovel would only be prized from his cold dead, etc. Ed Stocker, first of all, is Sessions just benefiting from the fact that Donald Trump can't really lose a national security advisor and an attorney general in the first 6 weeks?
Well, I think it's, to a certain extent, yes. I think, both Trump and, Sessions are doing everything they can to salvage this. I mean, another top level member of the inner circle, if you like, of Donald Trump's team leaving would be pretty catastrophic. And so I guess they're kind of doing all they can to try and salvage this situation. We'll have to see what happens. He's kind of so far survived the day. We'll have to see if there are any more revelations.
One at a time. James Chambers, the compromise he struck yesterday was that he would not quit, as a great many people were urging him to, but that he would recuse himself from any investigations into links between the Trump campaign and Russia. Now, obviously, that's going to be a fairly important investigation. How damaged / undermined is he by having to make that concession?
It reminds me of that scene from The Departed when Matt Damon's character is given the job of investigating the kind of the mole, and he is the mole himself. And the Attorney General's job is to oversee that investigation. So, of course, he had to stand down. I think this is a case where actually the lie is perhaps bigger than the offence itself, because
as is so very often the case,
he's a senator. He was a senator, and he met with the Russian ambassador. That in itself is not, nothing criminal in that. Actually, he could be doing his job. It's just the fact that he went on and perhaps lied about it, which made it a bigger offence.
I mean, it's sort of crazy to me. I mean, I think it's sort of, you're sort of seeing the Trump administration get how to play the political game, I think, in this kind of move. You know, if Sessions then yesterday had said, actually, yes, I'm resigning and I need to go, it's just when we thought things were maybe stabilizing, a more presidential tone from Donald Trump before both houses of Congress, well, then the sort of wheels come off the train again, and then it's sort of back to square one. But I think it is crazy that you have the most senior, legal figure, basically, in the government, who isn't overseeing the most important investigation underway in the United States, arguably, at the moment. But I think Donald Trump would have been advised that this was the way to go forward, because I think we're still seeing an element of, political rule breaking. Donald Trump is still not, following the script. He's sort of writing his own. And I think that the people closest to him, those more, you know, sort of stalwart politicians, still, you know, still figuring out how that kind of works in reality, I think. So, you know, they're saying, well, look, this is a political compromise we can do. But it is, you know, looking at papers, it's mad. It's absolutely crazy. And I think, you know, the Democrats actually are quite right. And of course, they would be calling for him to resign. But I do think they're quite right that, you know, it is an insane situation, really.
Ed, the Trump administration keeps insisting that there is nothing at the bottom of these allegations about improper contact with the Russians, that there is no fire below the smoke. Just for fun, because it is an always interesting mental exercise, let's try taking Donald Trump at his word and assume he's telling the absolute pure-hearted truth, that there was no improper contact between his campaign and the Kremlin. What options does he have, if that is indeed the case, if we are gravely misjudging the man, what options does he have for making this all go away?
Yeah, I think he's going to struggle to make it go away because it's become such a hot button issue. I think the fact that, you know, we now see two members of his inner circle embroiled with Russia means that, you know, I think the Democrats are going to push and push and push this for all it's worth. I guess, as we were saying before, it's not really necessarily the fact that they've had these meetings with the Russian ambassador. It's just the fact that they've got themselves so tangled up in the whole mess. It's also the fact that the White House and the Department of Justice aren't saying the same thing. So it's essentially a shambolic affair.
Because when we did see before the press conference yesterday, both President Trump and Sean Spicer, his press secretary, saying there was no need at all for Jeff Sessions to recuse himself from the investigations.
And then he does.
Exactly. Actually, that's what I have to do.
It's just part of constant mixed messages that we're getting out of this White House, not just perhaps them going against various departments, but also the fact that you have different people within the Trump administration saying different things, despite his claims that it is a well-tuned machine. It doesn't seem to be that at all.
To tap into that, I think, you know, a lot of this for me still strikes me as well. You know, Donald Trump just has no idea what he's doing. You know, he's sort of blundering around. But, you know, someone like Jeff Sessions, who's a very experienced person, knows exactly what he's doing. And I think, you know, if he is in his Senate committee sort of confirmation hearing saying, no, I've never spoken to the Russians, that is untrue. But I was speaking in my capacity as a senator, you know, involved in sort of reviewing defense and security issues, then that is something you would think someone who's experienced in politics, experienced in the areas of diplomacy and, you know, defense and security, would not have a problem in admitting and would not see as a problem in getting confirmed, you know, to this post.
So you think that suggests he may have something to hide?
I absolutely think it has to. And I think a lot of these kind of, you know, messages sort of, you know, coming out in the sort of chaos of this Russia scenario, you know, does kind of make me think, well, it is really, really fishy. It's really suspicious, because otherwise, you know, or is it just total sort of, you know, blundering into the dark? Well, and if so, that's kind of equally kind of serious.
What I wonder, and final thought from you on this, James, is whether it's not so much blundering in the dark as blundering in the light, that for all the prominence that these people in this administration may have enjoyed in their previous roles, they now find themselves subject to an intensity of scrutiny, the like of which they have not previously experienced, and maybe they are just freaking out a little bit.
But the guys that are surround Donald Trump, these are qualified people, a lot of them, not all of them. And what's I find interesting is that, you know, Donald Trump is the Teflon Don. He's untouchable. He can say anything and do anything and it doesn't matter. What the Democrats are finding that is the weakness about Donald Trump is the people around him. And they can chip away at these people and get them unseated in a way that they can't seem to touch Donald Trump. So in a way, the Achilles heel for the Teflon Don is these people around him. And I think they're way more qualified than he is. They've got a lot more experience than he has. And yet they're the ones who are being turfed out.
But he's relying so heavily on those people because, you know, they're the ones who actually, you know, have to steer the ship for him. So suddenly when you have your Kellyanne Conways or your Sean Spicers kind of getting into hot water, you know, he's becoming kind of quite an isolated figure because he has no idea to address or solve these problems himself.
Okay, well, let's move along now to Beijing, which will this week be hosting the two most significant wingdings of the Chinese political calendar, these being the National People's Congress and the National Committee of the Chinese People's Political Consultative Committee, which is catchy. There is much to discuss. There always is when the future direction of the world's most populous country is concerned. But recent events in the United States do lend proceedings an extra layer of intrigue, if not bewilderment. James, this is all happening reasonably close to where you usually work. How substantial are these conclaves? Don't the Communist Party basically stitch everything up in advance?
Yeah, they do. All the big decisions are made by the Standing Committee of the Politburo, which is basically seven men, which includes the President Xi Jinping and the Prime Minister Li Keqiang. This is kind of the rubber stamp that passes all those decisions and those laws, and then it's announced afterwards. This is when we get to hear what they've already decided. As you said, it's a huge gathering. It's a massive party. You know, Beijing gets shut down, all the factories closed, so the sky is blue, and you can't have any airplanes in the sky, no taxis in Tiananmen Square. And you get 5,000 members from all across China coming to take part in this. You get the party leaders, you get the businessmen, you get people like Jackie Chan turns up for this. Usually this is the biggest event of the year. There's a bigger event happening in November, because that's the five-yearly kind of Congress, so that'll slightly overshadow this one. But what's going on in America, because this is the first one since the Trump election, so that really is overshadowing what's going to be decided at this meeting this year. Because normally all the fuss and the attention is on the GDP figure. So they'll pick a figure out the air and say we'll grow by 7% this year, and then you'll see that'll happen. But because of what's happening in America, we expect a lot more focus to be on how much money they're injecting into the defense budget.
It is really depressing the degree to which Donald Trump has got what he clearly always wanted, which is that literally everything actually now is about him. Ed, do we get any sense yet from, trying to see this from America's point of view, whether or not China have actually figured out how they're going to play the next 3 years and 10.5 months, not that we're counting?
I don't think so. I mean, it really depends when we get a bit more detail on this hike in military spending that, of course, he announced recently, almost 10% hike. I mean, he has talked about, America being more present in conflicts like the South China Sea. So if he continues to poke away at China, I think that's when we'll see more of a reaction from Beijing. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, if that is just hot air, or if he actually really does intend to embroil himself in that issue.
Just to sort of swing this slightly to my sort of own patch, I mean, defence and Canada have had kind of quite a sort of interesting relationship, I think it's fair to say. Justin Trudeau, when he was elected in 2015, swung the rhetoric pretty firmly away from this kind of boosting of defence kind of budget that Stephen Harper, his conservative predecessor, had sort of really put a lot of, as well as political sort of clout behind, a lot of emotional clout too, really. But, we've seen the focus shift to a more humanitarian sort of military response, or like training kind of forces, as you well know, Andrew, in Ukraine, for example, or welcoming refugees across Canada's borders. I think it is quite interesting that at the moment we're seeing the leadership race for the Conservative Party in Canada really sort of heating up. That election takes place in May, but you're really having kind of quite an interesting fight, if you like, about what conservatism in Canada should mean and does mean. And I think that, the Trump administration is definitely colouring that. Canada's got its own sort of version of Donald Trump, if you like, a reality TV star who is, gunning for the leadership of the Conservative Party. But I think defence will undoubtedly become quite a big sort of part of that conversation, I think. Canada's economy is not doing that great. It's criticised a lot. It's one of these countries from NATO that isn't actually paying its sort of 2% and isn't sort of, stepping up. Those countries have been in Donald Trump's sort of line of fire. So I think, it'd be quite interesting to see, really, I think, how Canada feels it needs to kind of define kind of its the sense of the idea of defence, really, kind of in military terms, kind of in the years going forward.
James, aside from trying to figure out what on earth America is thinking, what will be the other priorities of these conclaves in terms of, I guess, the domestic governance of China?
Well, in China, the big concern for people these days is pollution and health. So we expect that to be a big issue, because that's the one where the general public in China are actually beginning to kind of speak out. That's something you don't normally see on things like, you know, necessarily the economy or defense. But when it comes to the pollution, that's when they're really letting their voices be heard. And that's a novel thing in China. So Xi Jinping in the past has, you know, he's been on the front foot when it comes to the environment. You know, he was there with President Obama at the Paris meetings. And now that Trump has kind of exited that exit stage left, I guess Xi Jinping sees a big opportunity to be not only the figurehead for globalization, but also the kind of the spokesperson for the environment and saving the world. So I would expect that when he speaks, he's going to say something about the environment.
And just a final thought from you on this, James. Will China look to seriously address defense spending? Because they must sort of have these sort of conversations about whether there's ever even all that much point in trying to keep up with the United States, which already spends three times what China does on defense, and obviously from a fairly substantial head start. And that's even before Donald Trump's promised increases are taken into account.
Last year, it surprised everyone. It was the first time they raised the defense budget by a single digit, so it was about 7%. This year, everyone's expecting it to be back in the double digits. But as you said, it's still way behind the U.S. But what's really concerning is not just the U.S. that's kind of ratcheting up its defense spending. It's kind of there's a regional arms race going on. The Swedish think tank has published a recent research showing that, you know, Vietnam has increased its defense imports by 200% in the last 4 years. Philippines is also spending a little bit more on defense. So, you know, it's not just China. It's not just U.S. There are other countries in the region who are kind of freaked out by what's happening in the South China Sea. Everyone's putting more money in defense. That's not a good sign.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller. Coming up next, how much camel power can your car boast? And we'll find out why Japanese films are once again top of the box office at home. Do stay tuned.
Can you smell that popcorn? Well, while you're waiting in line, let me tell you about some of the standout guests we've spoken to recently on The Cinema Show. This year's Palme d'Or winner Ken Loach told us how going back to basics was integral to the strength of his winning film, I, Daniel Blake.
Paul wrote two characters which have quite simple, straightforward situations.
Fellow Palme d'Or winners Jean-Pierre and Luc Dardenne told us how reaching the heights of the film industry can have its downside.
Because after Cannes, the reactions were mixed. Some good, some less good.
And Canadian filmmaker Xavier Dolan gave me a glimpse into his creative process.
What matters in making movies is all the elements are working and walking at once in synchronicity.
So now you've heard the trailer, all you need is the main attraction. Tune in to The Cinema Show on Monocle 24 every Friday at 20:00 in London. Or download the podcast now. You'd better hurry with that popcorn though. The movie's about to start.
You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. And joining me now from Monocle's bureau in Tokyo are Kenji Hall and Fiona Wilson. And from our Istanbul bureau, Chris Lord. Now, horsepower. I did not know when I woke this morning. It was originally calibrated by Scottish steam engine pioneer James Watt to express the performance of his rail contraptions. It has, of course, since become the standard measurement of a car's motor. Nissan, however, has tweaked the concept to pitch 4x4 vehicles to markets in the Gulf. Henceforth, Nissan's SUVs will boast of their camel power. Chris, first of all, it's not like horses are unheard of in Arabia. There's, in fact, a sort of horse called the Arabian horse. Is this actually necessary?
Well, I think calling it Arabian horsepower might sort of, like, you know, reveal their intentions too clearly to market this thing to the Gulf market. I mean, look, first of all, there is some degree of science behind this. Basically, camel power is the ability of a vehicle to tackle off-road desert conditions, basically. This is the new thing that Nissan has proposed. And there is a formula behind it. There is certain things that you can do to say, okay, this vehicle is therefore more adept at going off-road than the other one, and so on and so forth. But the reality is that this is a very simple, very probably not too costly marketing device, because they know that calling something camel power by touting its abilities to get off-road, especially on sand, is gonna do well to bring those Gulf buyers back, because the car markets in the Middle East have just not been what they used to be in this era of cheap oil that we're living in.
Fiona, among the many things I wonder about this is whether this might be a bit of a branding own goal. I have ridden on a camel. It is slow, uncomfortable, smells terrible, and they're an incredibly temperamental vehicle. I'm not sure on its association I would wish to make, but how concerned are Nissan about those markets that Chris just mentioned? How important is the Gulf to Japanese cars?
No, of course these markets are important. I mean, you know, generally Japanese car makers are worried about, I mean, in Japan, the demographics are against them. They're constantly talking about the carless generation. Young people are not buying cars, so they're having to be a lot more creative with their marketing, and they have to target markets more specifically. It's not enough anymore just to, you know, stick Leonardo DiCaprio in a Suzuki wagon or whatever he was driving and hope that sells cars. It doesn't work anymore. They have to do a bit more, really, really persuade people.
I mean, Kenji, when Japanese car manufacturers aren't coming up with sort of, you know, gimmicky concepts like this, what virtues do Japanese cars sell to the world? Because the development that Japanese manufacturing, not just in automobiles, has made in the post-war period. I mean, there was a time within living memory when made in Japan, the idea of it was regarded as something of a joke, as indicative of something sort of cheap and tacky, where it's now regarded as something, you know, impeccably well-designed and well-made that will never break.
Well, it's an interesting question because you have to remember a lot of these automakers have diversified. They no longer make all of their cars in Japan. So, you know, even though the brand is made in Japan, it represents made in Japan, the cars don't necessarily come from Japan. I think, yeah, it's an interesting idea that that these car makers do have to continue to promote themselves in places where, you know, they might not have much have made much inroads.
Fiona, is there a handicap, or do Japanese car manufacturers feel a handicap in that Japan is, I mean, it is perceived not incorrectly by the rest of the world as an incredibly industrial, urbanized society where one might have debatable amounts of use for a tough four-wheel drive?
I mean, if you go around Tokyo, you see plenty of tough four-wheel drives. You don't need to be off-road. You can be in a Motosando. So
the same is tiresomely true of London. Well, we can only wish them well with camel power. I'm not sure it's going to catch on, but I've been wrong before. We will move along finally tonight to a couple of stories from Japan, the first of which is a home hit at Japanese cinema. Last year's biggest film in Japan was the locally made animation Your Name, which beat global chart toppers Captain America and Rogue One. Kenji, first of all, why was this film such a success?
Well, that's the question that I'd like to ask, actually.
Well, it's always the question. If everybody could answer that, then we could all go and make hit movies.
Well, I mean, I'd like to say that I've actually seen the movie, but I have not yet. So, you know, I can't really speak that authoritatively about it. You know, it has hit records. I think it's the second most popular box office hit in Japan in history. It's helped sort of rejuvenate Japan's local film industry as well. Previously, if you look at data going back, you know, the past 20, 30 years, Hollywood films were always on top. These days, it's Japanese films. And so I think, you know, for at least Japan's film industry, it's very encouraging.
And just to follow that up, Kenji, what do you ascribe that to? If more people are going to see Japanese films, does that mean Japanese films have got better or the American ones have got worse?
I wish I could say that they had gotten better, but if you look at the list of films that usually top the ratings, it's usually the typical sort of monster movies, escapist fare. One of the more popular series that we see in Tokyo often is one about the sea monkeys. This is a promo film essentially for the Japanese Coast Guard that comes out, you know, every other year practically, and it's essentially you know, one of these kind of thriller rescue at sea type movies, and they're formulaic, and you know, they're very popular.
Fiona, do you have any sort of views on what it was about this film that resonated with the Japanese public?
Yeah, I have seen it and I also loved it. you know, partly as well, if you know Japan really well, I mean, one of the things that really appeals about these anime films, and Spirited Away, which is the highest box office success in Japan ever, has the same quality. It's a very detailed picture of Japan. It, you know, and Your Name is the same. I recognise places in Tokyo. It's drawn really, really beautifully. it really resonates with the Japanese audience. And I think, you know, they're not going to get that from another filmmaking country. So, it taps into this love of anime, manga, and, you know, it's a very emotional film. And I think I've talked to people who are running cinemas and they said, actually, a lot of young people now, they're not really interested in watching films with subtitles. They like a Japanese film in Japanese they can watch. So generally, and I notice this, I love going to the cinema. The sort of range of films that are distributed in Japan has really shrunk. So for someone like me, I have to wait till they come onto some other format. I'm not seeing so many films in the cinema. There's much more Japanese cinema. And yeah, I mean, they're thrilled. And it's interesting that Rogue One, it did well, but nothing like it was expected to do. So these big hits everywhere else are no longer rock-solid hits in Japan.
Okay, I did want to look at one other Japanese story, which is the ongoing drama surrounding the relocation of Tokyo's Tsukiji, which I've almost certainly got. Is that right, Tsukiji Fish Market?
That's right, Tsukiji.
Near enough. It's about to cost Tokyo City government 9 billion yen in compensation to businesses which have been left out of pocket by the delay. I have been to the market many, many years ago. It is absolutely astonishing. I can assure viewers, it's even more astonishing when you're sort of desperately trying to fend off seafood-induced food poisoning so you don't miss out on it. I have very mixed feelings about the market that particular day, but it is absolutely spectacular. Kenji, first of all, why do they need to move it?
That's a good question. That's the most basic question, and it's principally because the current site, Tsukiji, which was built in 1935, is too small for the amount of business that goes through there. I have some stats. 1,800 tons of fresh, frozen, and processed seafood go through the market daily. There are 480 types of seafood, and daily turnover amounts to 1.5 billion Japanese yen, which is 12 million euros. It's just an enormous amount of fish going through there. And, you know, they've found that the quarters for most of these traders are so small, and it's become, you know, at the same time, they have developed a system, a way of working, a workflow over the past 80 years that seems to work for them. One of the criticisms of the new site, well, there are many criticisms of the new site, which we'll get into, but is that it was designed without the input from the people who are actually working there. And so it's not optimized for what they need. You know, the story that we're talking about today is really the former Tokyo governor, Shintaro Ishihara, holding a press conference just to say that he is not the one to blame for all the problems linked to the move to the new site in Toyosu.
Fiona, does anyone have any idea how this ends? Is there any clamor at all for just thinking, just forget it, leave it where it was?
No, it's really interesting. I mean, so many issues have come out of this. I mean, basically, the new site is toxic. This has always been a problem. They've known it for 20 years. They never resolved it. And instead of resolving it, they lied about it and said, we've done the work that was required. And a few people started saying, I don't think you have. And when Tokyo got a new governor last summer, one of the first things she did was start a proper investigation. And once they started measuring the soil, they saw levels of benzene, arsenic. I mean, just unacceptable. And it turned out they hadn't replaced the top soil. And it revealed a sort of corruption. And nobody wanted to take responsibility, including Shintaro Ishihara, who's, you know, four-time governor of Tokyo, who signed off on the whole thing. And, you know, Yuriko Koike, the governor, she's come under fire as if she is being difficult. Like, how dare she raise this issue? And she's causing a problem. We were just about to move last November and now we can't. So if anything, the clamour has been really critical of her. At least that's how it's perceived. I think, honestly, the public is supporting her and saying, no, we do not want the world's biggest fish market to move to this toxic site.
Chris, of course, in Istanbul, questions of town planning have started riots in reasonably recent memories. Just finally, before we go, Istanbul's similar in many respects. It has those lovely grand old bazaars and markets. How is it done at accommodating them within a growing city?
I think the best example is right near the bureau, Monocle's bureau in Istanbul. We used to have this great fish market down on the front of the Bosphorus there. And it was informal. It was a little bit ragtag, but you could go down, you could get a very cheap lunch, almost definitely caught just along the water's edge, somewhere along that way, fresh that morning, but the government couldn't tax it. And so there they move in, they get rid of it, they build something concrete instead, and it's just never quite as good as it, really.
We will have to leave it there. Thanks to our guests, Chris Lord, Fiona Wilson, Kenji Hall, before that, Thomas Lewis, Ed Stocker, and James Chambers. Today's show was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Helena Jarrett. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. The menu comes up at 1900, then it's the cinema show visiting the Vienna Film Museum at 2000 London time, and stay tuned for The Daily at 2200. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.